Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. We are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGG QA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series, but the QA is the important part. It's the question and answer as we get into a conversation about the top tech news stories of the week. Looking back on the last week, I like to hold my podcast on a Monday, so we get some time to kind of sift through our feels. And also, if some breaking news happened over the weekend, and you might be able to hear my voice is a little rough. The fine folks at TCL scheduled like a little outing, a little play date for some of their tech and influencer buddies. And some friends were there, like Shaka Armstrong and Josh Vergara. And TK Bay and DePoets made an appearance. It's always great to be able to hang out. Greggles and Ricky, the YouTube tech guy. I'm like forgetting people. Always really great to kind of hang out with some folks. But this is my very first outing to SoFi Stadium, and just talking to people in the loudness of that arena. My voice is going to be a little shaky this week. So you're probably like a couple weeks past, there'll be a lot of like pauses on this podcast as I like drink coffee and drink some water. Simon says, Hypno, you TCL shill. But I'm already seeing a cool group. There's a great crew in here already. I'm seeing Barry Johnson saying, Juan! Michael Corcoran, Muppinish. We've got to push pause right now, right here for a quick Juan doesn't have a soundboard of glory fanfare for Muppinish, gifting tier one subs to Baseball Super, Talks with TJ, Token Tech 320, FHJ Esquire. FHJ is very fancy. Farhan 8893, thank you so much. That is amazing, and I definitely appreciate the support producing on this channel, and I just... I'm overjoyed. People come in to hang out, nerd out, get their week started. This is the way that I like to do it. And, when I see this crew of people, when I see these faces in the chat, it gives me some hope for humanity. So, I'm sorry, we're going to go down. We see Ghost Starscream, Al Sabakli, Bray Gray, J-Man. I said Baseball Super. Did I say Baseball Super? Baseball Super saying the dulcet tones. I wish I could control the timbre of my voice and get this without blowing out my vocal cords. Lampros, Aditya Anil, Dave Burns, Ron Guido, Scoop, Bionic Scoop is in the house. Golan, Cup of Cash, Steve Pogue saying, what's up, hey nerds? Svetica saying, sup, beautiful people. So I think between the two, we're just a bunch of beautiful nerds. I love it. I love it. And Colonel Corn Pop. I still love that name. That is a delightful name that is just fun to say. All right. Let me get this out of the way here and get this down. Oh, Tech Preacher, what's up, Easy? He's saying, what up, peeps? Glad to see you in my chat, Easy. All right. I guess good this year. So, I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. I got to do something for the very first time this weekend. I was very excited about that. This is I'm kind of abbreviating some of this because we're taking our first steps. This is October the 2nd, which means we are now running headlong into Techtober. And there are going to be a number of second half of the year product announcements. Every company is scaling up for sales as we get into the holiday season. This is like harvest season for tech reviewers. And I still have so much stuff in my office. Like, I'm still behind on some of the videos that I was supposed to be making from, like, during the summer. That's how, like, scaled this production is getting. And I fear one of the things I'm just going to have to bite the bullet on and take a step back on, like, to get a video out. I mean, as we're talking, like, the budget to produce a sponsored whatever video is just like, I might have to do a video where I just like, here is the thing and I will hold it up and you can see it on camera and I'm just talking. And maybe there's one like punch in shot where I do this, but my camera won't focus. So, we might have to go minimal this month just to get everything done. Got to do another Juan Doesn't Have a Soundboard of Glory fanfare for J-Man150, gifting some tier one subs to Rami Vaden and Vazikos8. Thank you, J-Man. I'm glad to see you in the chat again this week too. Again, everybody, I really appreciate it. It's always a lovely time putting the show together and nerding out on some interesting news. Go Starscream. Juan, how are you this far behind when you're supposed to only cover Sam Googleable? because I'm so far behind because I've got like AR glasses on my desk. I've got I almost picked up something I can't show you. You got the Vivo that I still haven't shot a video on. Here's the Xiaomi that we are gonna be talking about. There's so many really fun things that are kind of spread out, and we're going to use this to segue into housekeeping here. I got two major videos out, and hopefully either this afternoon or tomorrow morning, I'm going to be putting out on the Patreon the performance charts. I'm still trying to find a way, and if anyone has a suggestion, I put that out there, and I do mean, like, I want to hear suggestions. I know a lot of us tech tubers will say, hey, if anyone has an idea on this, and then someone will suggest something and we'll be like, oh, but I can't use that. I understand we can be really snippy like that. But I really do appreciate some feedback or some ideas. Right now, I go through my Excel spreadsheet and I've just got lists of like how fast the phone could perform video rendering and audio rendering. And like I've got all of these like performance metrics. I like to test phone performance with real-world apps, not with synthetic benchmarks. So hopefully, either this afternoon or tomorrow morning, I'm going to have this those new charts out for the Xiaomi 13T Pro. This is using a refreshed chip from MediaTek. So I think it's worth looking at some of the performance numbers and say, like, did this really increase performance? We see, like, oh, 10% this or 15% that. Does that really translate into you doing anything faster on your phone? Does it really translate into you getting through this task more efficiently? And so I take all of those numbers and I just dump them into PowerPoint. And that's how I'm making all my charts and graphs right now. I just need simple bar charts that are not a pain to customize and design. And so far, the fastest solution I've found is PowerPoint. But we're also getting into like fractions of a second differences. So my charts start looking like all super consistent, right? Like there's not a lot of change here. So I want to be careful because I don't want to misrepresent the performance of these devices. I hate it when you see like a bar chart that's been scaled. He's like, whoa, look, this bar is like 3 times longer than this bar. It must be 3 times more better. Because I kind of want to show, if you have a phone with like a Snapdragon 865 from 2020, and you have a phone with an 8 Gen 2 from 2023, maybe the performance delta is just like a tiny little sliver of a difference in a specific app. And I want people to kind of understand like what that performance difference really looks like. Not, I scaled it to make the 8 Gen 2 look so much more performant. But also I know that like PowerPoint bar graphs are not fun to look at. See, Muppinish is saying, yes, add some random Scala mining hash rates as well. So Muppinish and I had a great offline conversation, and I did reinstall the app on one phone, and I'm sorry, Muppinish, I have not had time to test it, but we're talking offline, trying to create a benchmark for crypto mining. Like, our phones are stupid powerful. Maybe this is something that someone could do with a mobile-style device. So, yeah. If someone has... This is a resource I use to craft better-looking charts and graphs, and it's really easy to plug numbers into. I would very much appreciate just a point in a direction if... there's a setting I'm missing in PowerPoint. I'm putting that out into the cosmos, and sorry, I just caught up with the chat. Simon says Hypno, Snapdragon 865, that's Biden old. I think you meant Biden old, because get it, because Biden is old. It would be nice if we had a president again that was in any way relatable to people maybe, 30% older than me. That would be nice. Vasico's 8, you said 865 performance, and I almost threw up in my mouth. I love it. Simon says, Hypno Biden, bloody typing. Ah. Oh, autocorrect wins again. So we do have a little housekeeping to knock out. The main point of the housekeeping that I want to get at is there is something coming to the Patreon soon. I have tried to make those kinds of posts public. And both on written examples on my website and videos on YouTube, there is so little audience for practical daily performance comparisons on these apps. This content never gets shared. And if I take the time to make a video on it, it's one of those things is like the low watch time, the low retention, that hurts my YouTube channel. So I appreciate that some people have asked like, hey, why don't you ever put this stuff public? And you're like, I have. The fact that you're asking me about that means that you've never engaged with other public, or it's always someone who's like, well, I want to see how my Galaxy compares. And you're like, well, of course, if it was just Samsung and iPhone, then people would care about like benchmark races and stuff like that. But the second that I show a Pixel 7 Pro can outperform a Galaxy S23 Ultra in video rendering, well, oh, now that doesn't matter. Who would really do anything like that with their phones? As long as my phone's the winner, then I care. And I'll share that, and I'll comment on that. So it's pretty great. I'm going to take a drink of coffee here, and then we're going to just knock out the 2 posts that I did for housekeeping this week. And go Starscream. No one in this chat is gonna argue. Go Starscream says, my S20 is still kicking after 2.5 years. The Snapdragon 865 is such a beast. My phone haven't shut down on its own when we had some extreme heat this spring. When we were getting up into the upper 100s, I mean, my LG V60 of that similar era was hanging with 4K 60 video a bit better than some of these other newer hot rod phones. And that's absolutely something we're going to touch on a little bit. Especially as I've had a little life experience with some of our tech pals who are all caught up in the iPhone 15 review season. Well, we had an outing at TCL Stadium, and I was out there with my lowly little OnePlus 11, and maybe some people were reaching for the charger more than maybe I was. And I think it's an interesting state of affairs that we find ourselves in as we continue to promote higher performance devices to consumers, and at the same time, dismiss consumers as never doing anything but basic stuff on their phones. Because things like battery life, would certainly benefit from either larger battery capacities or more fuel-efficient SoCs. All right, let me get this housekeeping out of the way, because I also feel that because of what, you know, I was up a little late last night as a grown-up. I had an outing. I might be easily sidetracked this week. So let's screen share this right here. I'm not even on it. Okay, so the first major video last week, Xiaomi 13T Pro first look. Who is this phone for? Taking my first steps, my first look at cracking open the Xiaomi 13T Pro, playing around with some of the new hardware on tap. But then also another thing that we're going to talk about in the second half for the gadget block is I fear some of these companies have built business models on novelty, and it's getting a little tricky. If I'm doing my job, I feel my job is, can I properly identify the audience for a device? Can I properly say, this is who I think this phone might be for? So push pause on that idea. We're going to come back to it probably in about an hour. All right. And the other biggie is just like a fun segment that I like dipping my toe into this little pond. And I'm hoping to cover a few more options coming up over the next, or especially over Techtober. Ace Magic AD15 mini PC, it might be a good deal. And so it's a little mini PC build. This is an 11th gen Core i7. So we're not talking anything like radical, groundbreaking. It's a higher tier performance chip from almost 3 years ago. So I don't think any of us have any crazy expectations on what that might look like. And we all know the timing. This was one of the first, this was the first refresh that Intel came out with after the release of the M1. So we all kind of know, Intel sort of fell behind here and they were still sort of competitive there, but power management here. And I think it's interesting, like, In that review, I obviously break down a whole bunch of pieces and parts and like, oh, and I played some games on it and I rendered a video in DaVinci Resolve. And really, like, the CPU performance wasn't too far off an Apple M1. Like, the Apple M1 came out and when we saw that software-hardware synergy, when we saw good support for apps on the M1, like, that's where Apple showed, like, oh, a performance per watt advantage. Definitely the stitched on Intel GPU not keeping pace with Apple's M1. But when you start breaking down pricing, that's where I thought this got really interesting. And I have to point out, there's a pinned comment. I actually need to update the blog post on somegadgetguy.com. When I originally cut this video, I made one of the dumbest mistakes I have ever made in a video on my channel ever. Because I got like, so I'm trying to talk about pricing, and if you can undercut the price of a used M1 Mac Mini, then one of these 11th gens is actually kind of a great buy. There are lots of little pros and cons. I go into that into the video. And so I thought I had found like this one deal, this one part of Amazon, and I was stoked. Like, this is a crazy, ridiculous, it's almost $300. Like, it's just like $10 over. I'm going through all these other sites and all these, like, I can't believe there's like this one sale on Amazon. It's so much better. These little mini PCs always have sales across the web, even on their home sites or through other resellers or on Amazon directly. So it's like you see MSRP $600. You should never buy a box like that at the listed MSRP. That's just never a good idea. So I put it all together. I screenshot everything. I'm proud of myself because like I've done my homework. I know what's up, and I published the video, and I completely never caught that I had a $100 gift certificate on Amazon. So the box was $100 cheaper than everywhere else. And I was like, I can't believe it. This sales price is amazing. How could they pull this off? Someone had to point it out in the comments. Completely flew over my head. So the good news is, since publishing that video, Ace Magic has actually come out with an even better sale that is actually close to me having a $100 gift certificate. So the main point of the video still stands. I was so close to just pulling the whole thing and, like, reshooting my conclusion based on a $100 price difference. But I double-checked and I went back, and instead of the, like, 5% coupon on Amazon, literally when that went live, there was a new $125 and a 5% off coupon. So you could stack. And that brought the price just $15 higher than my original assessment with my $100 gift card. So I left the video kind of intact, but I cut the segment of me showing off my stupid shopping. I just sliced out the one little screen grab that I had in the video. But I can't think of another time in producing content on YouTube. And see, the thing is, I usually go into Amazon in like an incognito window. And I was just working really fast. I was working too fast and not double checking my work. I can't think of any mistake that I've made that is anywhere near as just doofusy, ridiculously bad. That one was hilarious. So I had a lot of fun with that. And everyone, please, on that video, have a laugh at my expense. Short story, incredibly long. If you're shopping mini PCs right now, it's actually a pretty good market to find some astonishingly powerful hardware from maybe a generation or two generations out. And I go into this in the Ace Magic video. I'm kind of repeating myself here, but for not a ton of money, you now have like mini media server, dorm room PC. It is overkill for like a student PC. Like, I'm looking at the Chromebooks that my daughter's going to be issued, I don't think next year, but the year after in grade school. And like, those are garbage machines. I don't understand how kids can really get any kind of work done on such low spec plasticky pieces of hardware, and how those things aren't just immediately trashed as kids start using them. And then you turn around, you look at something like this, and you're like, for not a lot of money, I could outfit her with a screamer mini PC. It's getting really good. The competition on this, as we have a whole market full of chips that were sort of built and fabbed and produced for a market that now doesn't exist, they're finding their way into these types of low-cost solutions, and you can get some crazy bargains on this kind of stuff right now. Simon says, no, that was a bit of a stretch. That was a bit of a stretch, Simon, but I'm going to read it. Too fast for pricing. Juan Lee Crew. I'm not a Motley Crue fan, but I feel like you kind of threaded it. I'll give you that, AKA Kami Juan. Hold on, let me get this down here. Yeah, Barry Johnson, you just gotta laugh. It happened for a reason. We all needed this laugh. We can all identify it as an honest mistake. And it was really too that I was so excited. I was so excited to like share this off, but apparently for me to make that video accurate, like everyone's saying here, well, I'll just give everyone who wants it a $100 gift card so that I can comply with my video. I'll not be doing that. I cannot afford to do that. I'm sorry. and Pup on Tech, have you considered venturing into more home lab stuff? I have. Unfortunately, I am but one man, and I've been spread a little thin for a while now. And so, I mean, like, the Patreon is in a good place, but we never grew to a point where I could kind of realize the promise of, like, bringing on other people. And unfortunately, we're in a market right now, a little behind the scenes, and then we'll get into some of the news block, and then we can cover this stuff. I you know, like, I'm trying to balance what I feel is like reasonable, and I feel like you chip me a buck on the Patreon and I am providing that quantity of value, and I'm very appreciative of people that contribute more, but I feel really good. Like, I feel like this is a fair back and forth. I'm trying to deliver extended commentary on these devices, the performance testing, going into some of the camera stuff a little bit deeper. And I feel like that's simpatico, and I feel like I'm doing a good job with that. But the hope was eventually that we could kind of keep growing on that side, hosting more of the conversations on the Patreon directly, because YouTube commenting is such hot garbage right now, and that eventually the Patreon would be able to subsidize me bringing on an editor or a producer, someone like that. So we keep like getting close, and then, you know, obviously the economy is in shambles, and like I can't expect of an audience to just like just keep throwing money at this. It's like we keep getting closer and closer, and then I've got to field more of the work myself. So when it comes to these other things, like there are other projects that I'd like. I'd actually kind of like to veer a segment regularly into more like home and kitchen tech. And it would be nice to play with some things like robot vacuums and all of these other aspects of living with technology that we form our personal area networks with. But the focus has to be on the things that I can literally fit in my office and, you know, like streamline the production so that I can reasonably account for my experiences and share those with other people. And I just don't have the bandwidth right now to not just learn, but get proficient enough that I can understand what I'm talking about and share that experience with someone more meaningfully. That's why I was so excited about like home battery backups and solar panels and things like that. Like, that's something I just need to do on my own, so it's something that benefits my family, and then I hope other people can kind of share from me showing as I'm learning what this stuff is about. But again, it's a very delicate line to walk, because people who are really into like living off the grid don't care to listen to a novice share his experiences. So that core demo isn't catching my videos on YouTube. So YouTube goes, well, those people are into batteries and they're not watching his videos, so we'll just not send his videos out to anybody. And you're like, I feel there are people who are like me, who are generally kind of tech savvy, but don't know a lot about this segment and would like to learn more, but I can't reach them because YouTube saw battery, went to the places where batteries are popular, and my commentary is novice. So I'm just disappeared. Like, it just did, that kind of stuff just vanishes. So yeah, the short answer is always yes, I would like to be covering more stuff, but yeah, time is a finite resource, so there you go. Anyway, why don't we knock out a couple news stories, because we've got some politics that we should get through. I know everybody loves talking about politics. I am of the mind that if you ignore politics, then other people get to make decisions for you. So at least if you can kind of stay abreast of what's happening in the tech space, you can contribute to conversations in any way that you might see fit. But the stance of, I don't like politics in my fill in the blank, is sort of untenable at this place. So hopefully you're along for the ride. I want to cue this one up real quick, because of course it's from my super awesome political man crush John Brodkin over at Ars Technica. FCC details plan to restore the net neutrality rules repealed by Ajit Pai. Democrats finally have a 3-2 majority needed to regulate ISPs as common carriers. And then from the article, Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel announced her plans in a speech today, one day after the FCC gained a 3-2 Democratic majority with the swearing-in of Commissioner Ana Gomez. The FCC previously operated with a 2-2 partisan deadlock because the U.S. Senate never voted on whether to confirm President Biden's first nominee, Gigi Sohn. And this is yet another ridiculous step in a tech situation that has been going on for almost 20 years now, as we've had the debates as to whether we should regulate data-based communications. The introduction of the internet was looked at as an add-on, as a service tied to our phone lines. So phone lines were granted these kinds of broad protections, but the internet wasn't. And then the internet took over and was still operating on decades-old regulations. And then we pitched the Open Internet Order under Tom Wheeler's FCC. And Tom Wheeler, I thought, was going to end up as yet another sort of telecom shill, but Tom Wheeler turned out to be a pretty reasonable FCC chair. And it took 10 years of open litigation, Verizon suing the federal government and winning, and then eventually crafting a new type of regulatory protection for the FCC to have some kind of say over how traffic is managed on the internet. And then that entire process of debate to litigation to actual lawmaking was undone in a year because of Ajit Pai and the Trump administration. And now we've seen again, we've got President Biden in office and we need to replace one of the FCC chairs. That is the president's purview so that he can craft the administration and the regulatory agencies that that administration wants to see. And again, the Senate just sat on one of the most qualified individuals to participate in, on that conversation. G.G. Sohn was a special counsel under Tom Wheeler. And so now we've exhausted years of the of Biden's first term in office, and we finally have this. And the reason why I'm pointing this out here is I'm actually kind of surprised that we saw as immediate a mention of this. So in the next, we should start seeing open comments that the FCC is going to start requesting comments from citizens, I think this week. It might be, if it hasn't happened already. This article is a couple days old. This isn't like breaking news this morning. So the first step for the FCC is to vote on a notice of proposed rulemaking that will seek public comments on the rules. Oh, the vote on the NPRM, notice of proposed rulemaking, is scheduled for October 19th. So 2 weeks. 2 weeks, we start the process of beginning to look at the potential to examine the consideration of returning to net neutrality policy. But again, anytime someone wants to say, oh, but you know, they don't know anything, or technology this, or both sides. No. Net neutrality was better for the country, and it was better for businesses to have a loose federal standard enforced by an underfunded commission that would only be hyper-reactionary to the worst transgressions of net neutrality policy, instead of having this patchwork quilt of different net neutrality rules across the country. We want to get back to the one broad federal standard that can then kind of supersede everything that's happening for businesses to understand what's going on. And so that process is going to start. I'm actually kind of surprised that the turnover, as soon as Commissioner Ana Gomez was voted on and installed, this was the first headline. So they had it ready. They had it ready and waiting. This would have been the policy if G.G. Sohn had been approved by the Senate. And it's ridiculous that we have stonewalled this policy. And again, it's always in bad faith. Oh, well, we need to wait to do this appointment because there's an election right around the corner. Oh, but we can bend the rules for our side. And that always seems to work in one direction. It never seems to always be both sides being problematic. Ghost Starscream, Juan should have been a politician. Or Juan should be a politician. I'm definitely unelectable, but I would love to be a policy wonk. I actually almost threw away all the tech reviewing stuff. It was about a year before the pandemic, and there was a pilot program in Washington, D.C., and I would have made no money. It would have been a miserably underpaying job, but I would have stepped into a medium tier role as a staffer and advisor for a senator. And I was eyeing that pretty hard. I put in a letter. I said, I know I am absolutely not the candidate you're looking for. I know you are looking at college graduates. And I threw my hat into the ring, and I never heard anything back, but I was that close to there's got to be something here. So I think when I grow up, and eventually when I decide that this whole YouTube relationship doesn't really work, is that's where I'm going to start looking at what can I bring to maybe a not-for-profit or maybe an advocacy group, or literally maybe I can, if I can keep some sort of visibility in this conversation, walk into a state house office and say, what do you need? Because this is something that I think is a conversation that's often glossed over. So we'll see. Simon says, I know, D.C. super expensive too. Yeah, it would have been a very difficult life transition, but that's the kind of conversation my wife and I were having. Like, maybe we need to try. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But let's see what this conversation might be like. So that's pretty good. Gappaletta, do we need the EU to come over and write some of our consumer laws? I think it's hilarious because yes, we do. Apparently, our own lawmakers are completely inept. Speaking of completely inept, this is another political adjacent conversation. Again, when we talk about regulatory agencies and we talk about oversight on big tech, we can point to examples like social media has been a horrifically toxic invention for political discourse. I don't think I'm being controversial there. I think we would all agree. Since the rise of the mega platforms for social media, citizen opinion on political topics has been ratcheted to such an insane degree that we can't have meaningful, earnest discourse. And the second you try, you get someone who's just in it to like poop post for the lulls. And then you've got active agents of weaponized misinformation. We've been seeing this in every region of the globe. We've been seeing this in every country. Social media is bad for this, and there's been woefully little oversight in reining in the spread of bad information, whether it be unintentional or whether it be active misinformation campaigns from bad actors in other countries around the world. So, look at this right here. So, this is coming by way of NBC News. X, formerly Twitter, makes cuts to disinformation and election integrity team. Let me get this right. The person familiar with the cut said four people had been let go. The entirety of X's election integrity unit in its Dublin office. It's unclear how many people remain on the team. X did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Musk appeared to confirm the cuts in a post on X, where Elon Musk posted, "Oh, you mean the election integrity team that was undermining election integrity? Yeah, they're gone." So at some point, because we've been covering a number of these stories for weeks on end, at some point, the agencies responsible for oversight on media platforms probably need to start actively pursuing some kind of corrective action with Twitter. I feel the number of sternly worded warnings, because apparently Elon Musk hates a sternly worded warning. He absolutely falls in line the second someone looks at him and says, "I don't think that's a good idea." And he's like, "You're right. I'll fly straight from here on." No, he is a bad faith participant in every single instance of what has happened with Twitter. I don't know what's going to cause the tipping point. What's the catalyst? Where does the country go? You know what? We're kind of tired of waiting for him to do this better. And this is causing active harm to a number of discussions online. And no, we actually need to take action and not just warn him that we might consider the possibility of the ramifications of taking action. Well, we're going to start talking fines and we're going to have to spend that time in court. They don't have the money to fight you in court. Twitter is in the negative and they've let go of so much of their staff. They don't have the ability to back up any of their moves here. So this is pretty brutal. This is very unfortunate. Yet again, we're running into another election season. We're looking at global politics on this macro scale. We know there is not a good faith participant from this platform. And this is a platform that used to be synonymous with that kind of in-the-moment news distribution. It's why I loved Twitter. It was my favorite platform. And it's time to stop warning him. It's time to start acting. And that's the big problem, is who's going to go first and start fielding some of those legal fees. And it's pretty rough. It's pretty rough. Because also, this was not a good news Newsweek for Elon Musk-owned properties. I don't like getting too precious with content warnings, but if you are sensitive to things like descriptions of hate speech, this next one might be one for you to just take a little bit of a beat, maybe go refill your coffee, something like this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. And again, yet another article from my man crush, political correspondent John Brodkin over at Ars Technica. This podcast not brought to you by Ars Technica. U.S. agency sues Tesla as black workers report swastikas, threats, and nooses. Quote, I saw KKK epithets, a swastika, and the N-word, black worker says. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission sued Tesla yesterday, alleging that the electric car maker violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by subjecting black employees at its manufacturing facilities in Fremont, California, to, quote, severe or pervasive racial harassment and created and maintained a hostile work environment because of their race, end quote. Describing retaliation, the U.S. agency alleged that Tesla, quote, has fired black employees within weeks of them reporting or opposing racial harassment. Tesla fired one black employee who had opposed harassment right after advising, her of Tesla's policy not to retaliate. So we're not going to retaliate, we're just going to fire you. Again, I feel like Elon Musk's style of management, this like move fast, disrupt, engage in like, you know, squishing down teams, not keeping proper groups funded and staffed that would, like, this is why you have a healthy HR department. It's not so much that you protect your employees, but you cover the company's butt. And even if it's only making the token efforts to sort of stem some of this behavior from the employees, the company at least gets to say, like, no, we're making these good faith efforts to try and keep a safe work environment for our employees. But when black workers in Fremont, California, are finding literal Nazi propaganda and images depicting lynching in their factory, then I feel, again, this isn't a sternly worded warning. I'm really glad to see a commission actually step up to say, no, you've got to deal with this with public disclosure in a court case so that people can see what's going on and that your employees have the ability to speak and defend themselves against some really dumb tactics. I'm reporting that this employee harassed me. Okay, that's great. This is a safe space. You can totally do that. The company's not going to retaliate, but you are fired. I'm laughing because it's so awful. I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at the plight of Tesla workers. This is such a terrible story. I've just read two little passages. John Brodkin has put the effort into a full... That's why I'm sharing this, and I hope you will click on the link, because all of the links for all of the stories we're talking about will be available on my blog, sungadgetguy.com. Click on that link. Give the click to John Brodkin. And read through, because there are also the links that help fill in all of the detail and the missing information that I'm just kind of glazing over right now. So Elon Musk is doing great. I just can't. Barry, this is what I said, man. This is blowing my mind. Barry says, this isn't Idaho or Mississippi. It's Fremont, California. Great job, Elon. There seems to be a little fog of rugged individualists who like to kind of lamprey eel, like latch themselves on to the media image of Elon Musk. And it's frustrating because let's say you're a technologist fan. I was a huge fan of Tesla. I still appreciate a lot of the things that Tesla has done for the EV community. But, you know, after a point, I can't separate the art from the artist anymore. And it's like, wherever he goes, there seems to be that little fog, that little periphery of individuals that are kind of the worst. Dave Burns, that's brutal, dude. They don't. I mean, you got like Gary Johnson out there. Sorry, Dave says, why do all libertarians keep ending up fascist? I mean, I will grant you, I think people of the rugged individualist fashion, let me say that better. I think people of the rugged individualist libertarian persuasion do fall for the myth of the strong authoritarian, right? You try and go through some Atlas Shrugged and it's just fan fiction for Big Daddy that keeps people in charge, and it's like a I'll take my ball and go home because I'm rich kind of a commentary. It's really difficult to kind of chew through. I don't think it's a great book. So I do feel like there is a thread of that in certain areas of libertarianism. But I do kind of miss the sort of weaker-willed Gary Johnson-style libertarians. Like, oh, I just smoke pot. It's pretty cool, guys. You know, like, there's that flavor, too. But whether or not it's libertarianism, it does seem to follow Musk. Like, oh, I like to disrupt conversations instead of participating with them. And then suddenly, like, you're posting horrifically toxic stuff. I don't know what the gateway, how did you get to that point? I don't want to investigate it because it seems like it would hurt my brain. But yeah, there does seem to be just like, and I'm not saying an exact, I'm not saying you can predict it, but a general trend of following in that direction. It's just really, really bad. Oh, Dave Burns, I did not know that. More Perfect Union and Another Org broke the story in 2022. I'll have to look those up. I was actually just stoked to see that, like, this was an active filed lawsuit. Not just, hey, we're reporting on it and yet another bad thing has happened, but it was like, oh, some part of our government is taking some action to examine what's going on. It's sad that the bar is so low, but it's refreshing that something is happening on. It kind of breaks my heart. Well, let me take another drink of coffee here.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, and I just want to shout, like, hey, Michael Peppertech just jumped into the chat. Apropos of YouTubery, Michael Peppertech, I posted a video after just over 3 months off. It felt so good. I still got it, like riding a bicycle. And I would ask that some of my friends here maybe go check out what Michael Peppertech published on his YouTube channel. Always glad to see you, searching and catching and getting back into the swing of things. I appreciate your commentary, buddy. So I'm glad you took a little time off. We all need to do some time off and some brain resets and stuff like that. So let's get this out of the way here. Sorry. Again, catching up with the rest of the chat. And again, I know I mentioned it and I shouldn't have, but the second you say something like Ayn Rand, then you get a bunch of comments and people have opinions and stuff. And I know. I brought up politics and I mentioned that as an example of a certain quality of commentary. That's on me. I kind of derailed the tech side of this a little more than I thought I would. So moving on, we do have a couple just little hardware announcements that I think we need to keep an eye on. And I think they could be really interesting. You've got to view these announcements through the eyes of someone who, like me, is getting increasingly more interested in a practical consumer augmented reality. I like what we can do augmenting the stuff that we see. Okay, so apologies. That was a really clumsy way to lead into this article. I'm very curious to see what's going on. And I'm sure we'll probably get some more demos and follow-ups soon because Qualcomm is going to hold their summit soon, I'm sure. But they're announcing two new Snapdragon chips for next-gen headsets and smart glasses. So we're getting the Snapdragon XR2 Gen 2. So it's not going to be an XR3. So we had an XR2. And I think we were naturally thinking like, oh, well, all the fabrication, all the processing, like this is a significant difference from the XR2 to the XR2 Gen 2. So I'm kind of curious, like, why they're sticking with XR2, right? It's not the XR chip Gen 2. It's not the XR chip Gen 3. It's XR2 Gen 2. Will there be an XR1? Will there be an XR3? But instead of XR1, XR2, XR3, it's XR2 seems to be the tier, and then the generations tell us how old or new the chip is. And so I'm curious to see, will we get a lower power XR1, or will we get a higher power? So again, the naming is confusing, but ultimately, what's going to be kind of fun here is going from the XR2 to the XR Gen 2. Going from the XR2 to the XR2 Gen 2, Qualcomm is boasting 2.5 times better GPU performance compared to the last generation, and up to 8 times faster AI speeds, optimized to support mixed reality devices with displays up to 3,000 by 3,000 per eye. So we're pretty confident. You know, like Apple Vision Pro, that's going to be Quad HD. I'm not Quad HD, UHD, 4K, whatever we're going to call it. But if we've got like a little Snapdragon chip here that is contributing to that kind of performance, and we're getting Meta Quest headsets that are going to be a lot less expensive than Vision Pro, and they're supporting 3,000 by 3,000 resolution per eye, that's going to be a significant bump in pixel density, especially for the fields of view that we're working with. I'm actually trying to produce a video right now talking about some of the AR numbers that we need to keep in mind. And things like resolution aren't as important as resolution per area. So we start using measurements like field of view and pixels per degree to start better reining in our conversations about like image clarity and pixel density. So that's a pretty significant step up. I mean, it's got all the other technologies too. They're saying Wi-Fi 7. It's now a much smaller production fabrication. So we should see not only performance improvements, but power management improvements. But then also there was a second chip, the AR1 Gen 1. And this one was kind of surprising to me, that the AR1 Gen 1 is more, they're looking at things like Ray-Ban's Meta sunglasses. But the Ray-Ban Meta sunglasses are like audio sunglasses that just have little cameras that can record stuff for social media. So there's a new version of the Ray-Ban Meta. They look more like sunglasses. They're a little sleeker. They've got cameras by each eye. And now they can record 1080p footage at up to 60 frames per second for up to a minute. And that's cool. I mean, they look good. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't even credit this. I'm pulling these stories off of Engadget. I'm so sorry. Sam Rutherford wrote up the review on the Ray-Ban Meta. And who caught... Oh, and he wrote up the XR2 Gen 2 story also. So I'm so sorry. I'm not doing my proper accreditation here. I haven't played with these. I wasn't really into Snapchat spectacles. I haven't really been interested in glasses that can record video. Instead, it's been... whether or not I can get information to my eye. And that doesn't seem to be what these glasses are about at all. So I'm going to reach out. I might try and hit up some of my older contacts at Qualcomm just to say, like, what is AR1 Gen 1 doing in a product that is more about recording video? So Yeah. It sounds... I'm not sure... It's difficult to wrap my brain around. I've been really into chip fab. I know part of my podcast had been derailed by like, oh, when you're talking about this processing and oh, and you go MediaTek and they're going with TSMC and Samsung and Angstroms and Microns and all this fun stuff. And it's really messy stuff, but that's actually one of the reasons why I'm kind of getting into it. These moves in the silicon industry have been very interesting because the sort of consumer practical experiences pan out over a window of time. So we make this announcement, there's a new chip coming. It's going to go in this headset. This headset arrives. You put it on. Wow, the resolution and the fidelity increased, and I can do more things, and the graphics can get more intense, and the head tracking can be more precise. But that all's kind of scaled back to what were the decisions that they made in moving forward with this chip, and where are they trying to put these chips in relation to each other? Because you're going to see stuff like this new XR2 Gen 2, and people are immediately going to try and find ways to compare that against the combination of Apple's M silicon and head tracking spatial computing chip. And you're like, those are fundamentally different platforms with very different power management concerns. But I feel like this is the sideways entrance where ARM is kind of taking over everything. The style of chip that goes into our phone is showing up in sunglasses, is showing up in goggles, in headsets, in new Chromebooks and laptop form factors. It's like it's making its way in this like broad proliferation. And we're still having these conversations like, oh, but I mean, if you want a workstation, you need this kind of CPU and GPU. And you're like, but for how much longer? And again, if it's like we're powering this really content-rich mixed reality experience off of a chip not too dissimilar from an 8 Gen 2, I think that's pretty good indication that we could be doing so much more with our phones and tablets. Like, that performance should be delivering other experiences and other form factors. So, yeah, it's pretty great. So I'm not sure what you're asking here, Michael Pepper. Why not just put technology into their Snapdragon chip to capture stereo video? Seems like it would get into way more people's hands than glasses as an additional expense to a phone. Do you mean shooting 3D video from phone cameras instead of trying to put them into glasses? I'm not sure what you're asking. But it sounded like an interesting combination of words for a question that I would like to dig into. So if you can clarify, that would be great. But so far, I've seen too many examples of 3D footage shot from phones where consumers don't care about 3D. So I don't know. That's for me. It's like I don't care about cameras and glasses because what I want is the ability to like see content. Like, if I've got a 3D video, I've got AR glasses that are really good at doing side-by-side 3D. It looks pretty cool. And it's cool. You know, you push a little button on the glasses, it distorts your view, and then the video image pops up, and it's side-by-side, and it goes... And then you've got sort of depth, and it's pretty sweet. So I don't know. And Kappa Cash, I will absolutely support. Google was a fool for killing Focals. Still mad at them for that. And I just turned on three phones on my desk because I said the brand name of that company. So, yeah. JGJ, could RISC V possibly go the VR, AR route or even the mobile route? So, technically, yes. There's really nothing holding back development on those things, but I do feel we're in for a multi-generational fight before RISC-V can scale, before companies can craft the experience on RISC that will transition them away from ARM. But we know that every major megacorp is looking at some small investment in RISC. Google has been delivering better support for Android on RISC. We know Qualcomm has a tiny little Skunkworks division that is looking at crafting their own experiences on risk and where it might be appropriate. And I would not be surprised to see a healthy portfolio of RISC-V for things like IoT, where maybe you can get away from ARM reference designs if we're unsure how ARM is going to handle their portfolio over the next couple of years. This market really does not like instability or even the threat of potential instability. And so I really do think RISC has a huge opportunity ahead of it for starting with like thermostats and televisions and security cameras and things like that. And then companies will feel like they have better control over their own destiny. And then from there, we might see the evolution and the development where we can bring these directly into more into higher performance products, things like mixed reality headsets. But it takes a while. It takes a while for a company to say, like, hey, we've got this sort of raw material. We've got this thing called RISC. Now, how do we shape it and craft that experience and get our developers to support it and then get the software to talk to it correctly and then get it out to a piece of hardware that consumers can use and do all of that in a way where hopefully the consumers never see the difference? Because that's where the poison pill always seems to end up. The second you say, well, it's just like this, but you might have to do this one thing first. It should just work. All right, we've got two more news stories here, and then we can kind of get back to just some general patter, some general chat. We were just talking about Qualcomm is putting out this new AR, VR, mixed reality chipset for headsets and for goggles. And then, let me get this right here. Notebook Check, who wrote this up? Deidre O'Donnell. Apple to cut back on 3-nanometer orders as market forces start to crush upgrade demands. Next-gen devices with shiny new cutting-edge 3-nanometer chipsets are now thought to meet with less consumer enthusiasm or FOMO than one might think as they start to emerge in late 2023 or early 2024. That, according to a respected industry analyst, has already prompted Apple not to splash out on the upgrade as much as it might have, while Qualcomm has already taken one major blow to its hope for 3-nanometer sales. And this is an interesting little slice of market analysis where Qualcomm is in a weird middle position, this weird middle spot, where Apple kind of soaked up the manufacturing capacity of this new chip size. And MediaTek locked on to some early chip manufacturing capacity so that they could get some of their orders in. And we were hearing some of these reports and rumors like it might lead Qualcomm to going back to Samsung for next year. I mean, that was one of the potential rumors. I don't know how all of these things are going to play out. But we also know that Samsung probably will be bringing back Exynos for Samsung devices next year. And I think we're going to get an early sneak peek at what Samsung's current flavor of chip production looks like when the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro arrive. And if they do really well, let's say Samsung finally improves their modem so it's not running as hot just to keep a data connection going. Let's say they rein in some of their CPU performance, their performance per watt issues, their manufacturing matures. That could be a really good indication of international, not North American or Korean Galaxy owners, but people in the EU and across other regions getting a better Samsung-built Galaxy phone. I mean, there's potential there. As much as I despise Samsung as a global brand, what we want to see is a healthy and a competitive chip manufacturing sector. The silicon industry needs competition, or our products start to get real stale real fast. Our chips start to get real stale. You didn't close the bag properly and use your little chip clip. So it's interesting to me when we hear stories like this, we know global demand is going to drop. Analysts are saying, like, second half of 2023, we could bottom out again. So we could lose year-over-year percentages of sales. And I think it's funny when people are shocked by these numbers. Like, the economy is in the toilet. Inflation or corporate greed has never been higher. Discretionary consumer spending is at its all-time lowest. And these corporations are still like, but how come people won't buy new phone? Buy new phone, people! Help economy. And you're like, but we don't want to pay you, and we want to replace your jobs with AI, and we don't want to, you know, here in the United States, we want to cut your medical benefits and your health insurance and all this other stuff, but buy new phone! Why won't buy new phone? So, yes, hey, Jermaine, what's up? I joined at the right time. Competition benefits us all. I clicked on your wrong comment. There we go. I joined at the right time. Yes, yes to competition only benefits us. But this is what's interesting. So TSMC is going into this, and they had orders from Apple that would have occupied a significant portion of their manufacturing capacity. Apple scaling back would mean there will probably be some opportunities for other companies to say, we too would like to book some of your fabrication capacity. And I'll be curious to see if that changes any of the relationships that have been rumored to be taking place between Qualcomm, TSMC, and Samsung. I don't think it's a controversial thing to say. 2 years of Samsung making Qualcomm chips was not good for us. And I feel Samsung needs a lot of work on improving their efficiency and improving their yields and refining their chip design. And I hope that they, over this last year, they took 1 year off of putting their own chips in the Samsung Galaxy S phones. I hope what we see at the end of that year are the structural improvements to make Samsung more competitive. I do not believe an Exynos, what is the next Exynos coming out? Is it the 2400? Or is that the one that was supposed to come out? Anyway, let's say it was the 2400. I do not believe an Exynos 2400 in 2024 is going to outpace a MediaTek Dimensity 9000 series or a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. Or an 8 Gen 3, I should say. Excuse me. I don't think it's going to outpace an 8 Gen 3. I just need Samsung to make a chip that doesn't nuke your phone battery, get that hot pocket going on, just doing basic stuff as your phone is connecting to 5G radio towers, and can give me at least daily battery life. Like, from the 8 Gen 1, my expectations are super low. And it's every opportunity for Samsung to exceed my expectations. Because at least even with that, then we would see global distribution and demand for a product that is at least a good daily driver competitive smartphone. Even if it's not the bestest, it's still going to be a competitive offering, which I don't believe we had with the 8 Gen 1. I believe Samsung created a chip so high performance but ran so hot that over time, the more I look back on the 8 Gen 1, the harder it is to say, like, hold on to those phones. I think if you can flip those phones, try and talk to your family members, I think they would have a better experience. So it's just, it's tough. Jermaine, well, I mean, who doesn't want a heater in their pocket? Getting close to colder temps makes perfect sense to me. Yeah, as someone who lives in Southern California, it's the hot pocket when you go outside and it's like 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're like, oh, one thigh is significantly warmer than the other thigh. It's not so good. Gormlord, Samsung did not do the 8 Plus Gen 1. 8 Plus Gen 1 was a return to TSMC. So the startling improvement that we saw going from 8 Gen 1 to 8 Plus Gen 1 all came because of TSMC. But again, it's going to be tough for Samsung if TSMC has some open space on their manufacturing roster and some companies can get in there where maybe they would have used Samsung's fab. Like, oh, we don't have any other choice and Samsung has these kinds of cutting-edge technologies and we want to use this. Oh, wait. TSMC might have some 3-nanometer open because Apple pulled back on some of their orders. And I know I'm making this sound like they're making cupcakes. It is phenomenally more complicated than like what I'm sort of oversimplifying here. The global politics and distribution and demand for silicon right now is crazy. It is a beautifully complex tapestry of market forces. And again, I think if you're sort of catching a stream like this, to dig into some of the news on that is mind-blowing. That we can ever arrive at a product that you can just, like, pick up and play a game on and make a phone call with. Like, it is astounding to me that anything ever gets finished in this industry the way that you've got to plan years in advance for technologies that haven't been invented yet, and you've got to design a product around that, write software for it, test it, get approvals from radio and licensing, and stick it all together and slap a price tag on it, and then someone goes, well, it's too expensive. Baseball Super, that's a very tricky question. So Baseball Super asks, what was worse, the 8-Gen 1 or the Tensor 2? So the Tensor 2 is in our Google products. So here's my Pixel 7 Pro, and here is my Pixel Fold, Tensor 2. And then 8-Gen 1, do I have an example on my desk? I do. So here's my Moto Edge Plus 2022, and this has an 8-Gen 1. It's never as simple as one metric. It's never as simple as, well, one got a better score or one drained the battery faster. The 8-Gen 1 still benefited from a number of Qualcomm technologies that I appreciated. And I think right now, Qualcomm is still the front runner for things like radio design, modem design, and power management for the communications equipment. So in that area, I believe the 8-Gen 1 was a more consistent phone than the Tensor 2, which is using a better Samsung radio than the Tensor 1, but Samsung's radio is not as good as Qualcomm's radio. Samsung's radio is not as good as MediaTek's radio, and MediaTek's radio is still kind of nipping at the heels of what Qualcomm is able to produce. Again, Apple just recently signed yet another agreement with Qualcomm just for their radio management hardware. So in that context, I would probably lean 8-Gen 1. In a number of performance contexts, if you're more CPU bound, if you're doing more apps and services and work, Tensor 2 is a surprisingly performant chip. It benchmarks so low, but then it crushes like image data, multimedia data, and it's just as performant for things like opening up documents and spreadsheets and signing PDFs and doing all of that work. So you really got to like compartmentalize. What is it that you care about in a phone? And if you were saying like, if it's like, oh, I want to make sure I've got radios and modems and connection and better signal, and I'm not losing sight of cell towers and stuff like that, I think you still got to give the win to Qualcomm. If you're saying gaming, I would still give the win to Qualcomm. The gaming conversation was always the weakest spot of Tensor 2. Tensor 2 is good at games. MediaTek is very good at games. And Qualcomm has been great at games. So again, it's more, can you find the right combination of deal breakers that you can live with, right? Something that's a deal breaker for someone else, you might not care about. So it's like, I don't even think you should base on like, what features do you really care about? It's really like, what's the weakest part of the phone? Is that going to hurt you? No? Okay, well, that's probably going to be a good phone for you. But I mean, there have been a bunch of times, like I'm cutting up, I'm doing things, like even on my OnePlus 11, I was cutting up a little video. I did a recent trip. I cut up a little video for Lex, and I can't just do a selfie video, right? I just can't. I have to put in B-roll for my, like, hey, Lex, I'm at this place and we're checking out this stuff. And oh, here, and you can get a close-up look at it. And so to do that, I shoot, you know, like using my telephoto lens, and I get all this close-up video, and then I stitch it into the timeline. And the OnePlus 11 is a champ. It is a screamer phone. And I'm scrubbing through LumaFusion, and I'm putting the clips together, and I go to hit render, and I know a Tensor 2 would have rendered this so much faster. And not really like so much faster. It probably would have been like 10% faster. So for a video that rendered in under a minute, it would have saved me like 5 seconds. But I'm still like, five whole extra seconds that I got to wait and watch this thing render. And that's what happens when you're totally spoiled by getting to play with all these different devices. So I'm sorry, Baseball Super. That was not a very concise answer, but that's the kind of like nuance that I wish more phone reviewers would get into, because I'm picking up these other devices and I'm picking up these other phones, and I feel we keep losing sight of what consumers really would care about. If you'll allow me just the quick little tangent, I actually did have one more story here. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it. This the first link that I was able to pull up came from BBC News. This is why your new Apple iPhone why your new Apple iPhone 15 is overheating. And just the underline for the article is Apple has blamed a bug in its operating system and updates to apps such as Instagram for its new iPhone 15 overheating. But Apple passing the buck still doesn't quite address a trend that we've seen in portable electronics. And we keep selling more and more and more performance in the context of chips that can do more number crunching and do more calculations and do all of these cool things. But our devices never get taxed to that degree. I like to show off things like, you know, video rendering as a test. I think it's very telling that tech reviewers will dismiss those kinds of conversations in light of every single social media platform on the earth trying to piggyback off of the success and popularity of TikTok. So average consumers don't do things on their phones, but the most popular current trend in social media is short-form video clips that are recorded, sometimes incorporate really interesting editing capabilities like green screening, AI manipulation for like filters and augmentation, will incorporate other videos as like picture-in-picture window style add-ons or second layers if you were editing like kind of layer-based. And then all of that video data needs to be organized, compressed, and then uploaded. So yes, they're not going into DaVinci Resolve and making cuts and using all of the tools that good, you know, video editors are aware of, but they're doing work that's almost as complex. It's just a bit automated for how their workflow pans out. So shouldn't we want to know what phones really are better at performing those tasks? Because even in one generation of CPU design, there are some phones that are really, really good at video rendering. And then using the exact same chip, there are some phones that aren't as good at doing the same task. It's just like, hey, I've got this, you know, Intel Core i9 and I've got this RTX 4090. Well, you can take those two components and you can put them in a dozen different computer cases and they will perform different based on the different configurations and the airflow and the software and everything that kind of goes into making a computer. It's not enough to say it has a 4090. That performance can be different. So, I did that little video for Lex. I was thinking like, man, if I had edited this video on a Pixel, the render would have gone faster. The whole performance per watt conversation got kind of interesting yesterday. So we're down at SoFi Stadium. Excellent coverage. I mean, like, you know, Verizon built out towers all around, but like even I'm on Mint Mobile and I'm like, man, my 5G speeds are kind of ridiculous. So not only is there the Verizon UW, you've got the T-Mobile UC, right? This is a 5G hotspot. But on top of that, TCL was very kind. They put us up in a little booth, a suite, excuse me, they don't call it a booth, put us up in a little suite, and we had Wi-Fi. And I never got on the Wi-Fi. The 5G signal was great. I didn't want to, you know, like log into the service and do stuff like that. But I had a few friends that were really kind of going through their social media on the day. And a number of them, almost everybody in the room was rocking an iPhone of some kind. But there was a sort of an imbalance in iPhone 15s. And so we get through the football game and you just see chargers, because we were at the Chargers game, you just see iPhone chargers like all over the suite. And people are like plugging in and topping off their iPhones. And then we get to dinner and I'm sitting by two of my friends and both of them have batteries plugged into their iPhone 15s. And again, I probably wasn't hitting screen on time quite as hard as some of these guys because, like, I was, like, watching the football game. I'm not a huge football fan, but, like, This is my first game at SoFi Stadium. I want to see, like, this is an incredible experience. Yeah, I went from 7 a.m. to midnight, never plugging in my OnePlus 11, and I was down to 50% charge at the end of the night, with quite a bit of, you know, camera work, uploading. I shared a few photos on Mastodon, and I even posted something to Twitter for the first time in a while, and Instagram, stuff like that. I never thought about my battery. Like, I had no battery anxiety that whole day. I feel Apple has kind of gotten away from a design idea that really does appeal to the masses. And when you just put in a hot rod chip into a phone and you don't take into consideration things like thermal design, how do you get heat out of this new super high performance chip? And you don't make more of a design effort to handle the actual performance load of that new chip, you end up with a poorer consumer experience. Sure, the phone is more powerful, and in a quick burst of activity, it will accomplish one task faster. But that doesn't extend to longer consistency of performance, because we'll maybe see the iPhone 15 throttle more aggressively than the iPhone 13. I feel like the iPhone 13 was like sort of the high watermark, because going from the iPhone 11 to the iPhone 12, we added a higher performance chip and 5G at the smaller battery capacities. So Apple screwed all of their customers there. Then the iPhone 13 came out and they refined their chip design, made it more efficient per watt, and gave us bigger batteries. So you got a double whammy. The chip got more efficient and you got a bigger battery to work with. And then I feel like the iPhone 14 didn't really capitalize on that momentum. So if at best it just sort of maintained, but at worst you heard some reports of like gaming that like the chip would throttle. And you can get more consistent frame rates on a game like Genshin Impact on an 8 Gen 2 than you can on the supposedly more powerful iPhone 14 Pro. So all of those things, it's like, it's a weird place for Apple to be in right now, because Apple customers don't need uplifts in CPU and GPU power. I think they're correct to, you know, use some of these the space for more transistors for things like the AI, the machine learning, camera processing. I think the camera processing on the iPhone 15 has taken a nice appreciated step up. The iPhone 14 I thought was garbage. The iPhone 15, I'm looking at photos from some of my friends like, okay, these are looking better. These are a lot more competitive with like my Xiaomi and my Vivo photos. So this is one of those dicey topics, because I feel techies, tech reviewers, keep looking at the market and saying, oh, but I need a more, I need a higher performance chip today, because like 3 or 4 years from now, the software is going to be so much heavier and I want the performance to last. And I don't believe that that's really playing out in a practical sense. I believe if you could take a phone from 4 or 5 years ago, give it a battery refresh, you know, get a fresh battery in there, and then if you could optimize the current operating system for that older hardware, it would not only run, you know, it would be indistinguishable from a newer phone today. I don't believe we're getting to the apps and services and the operating system updates that really make use of all this performance. Consumers are getting chips that are significantly more more powerful, but that comes at the expense of battery life for dubious benefits. I get through my day, I handle a couple phone calls, I listen to a podcast, I stream some video, I'm surfing the web, I'm doing some TikTok, I'm scrolling through my Instagram feed, I shoot a couple photos. That's a mid-ranger chip at best. And a mid-ranger chip, being more power efficient, would give them so much more runtime per battery capacity. And Apple doesn't have a solution for that. They make the A series, they call it the A17 Pro now. They make the M series for their computers and their tablets. But they don't make something that addresses the core conversation around their products. And that to me is like, it's a really dangerous place to be. because you still need to keep showing these benefits and these perks and these improvements and these iterations, but then you didn't actually make the situation better for what people said, and then it starts to feel really cynical. Because then it's like, oh, well, we know our phone can't really last the day if you're using it like this, so you, what you need to do is buy one of those new MagSafe battery packs. And now there's a disposable battery. You know, it's in a couple of years, that battery will be e-waste, and you slap that onto the back of your phone. And we're sort of fine with iPhones with lumps attached to them as the solution for Apple not delivering an option as a better communicator device for daily driver needs. And I don't know that there's a solution out of that. I think Apple has built a ratcheted business model where they depend on all the revenue from all the accessories and from all of the solving all the problems that their product creates. And I come to these practical demonstrations. I went all day at an NFL stadium and my battery was down to 50%. Like, I feel like I did pretty good. I went all day next to some iPhone 15s and none of them seemed to handle similar tiers of use as gracefully as my OnePlus 11 did. So how do you fix that? How do you convince iPhone owners that like a feature like battery life should matter more, and that it's the solution isn't buy a wireless charging battery? I'm really struggling with that part of the conversation, because otherwise it just looks like, oh, but you're an Android nerd, so you just hate iPhones. And you're like, well, I mean, yes, but you could be, if you say you think you care about something like whether or not your phone can last the day in a high use situation, like going to an NFL game, then this stuff should kind of matter. And especially for some of these phones, like, and some of them were older. So definitely I saw some iPhones with home buttons, right? So, okay, that's not a surprise. You see an iPhone with a home button that's plugged into a charger. You're like, okay, I get it. That's an older iPhone. Battery is degraded. Totally get it. But when it's like iPhone 14s and iPhone 15s, and you're like, you should not be on a charger right now. We just made it through lunch. Well, I'm going to take a drink of coffee here.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey everyone, this is Zach of Zach Talks Tech. If you're looking to make sense of the tech that you love, if you're looking for an unfiltered opinion, someone who's just straight to the gun, gets right to it, no nonsense, come on over to Zach Talks Tech. I stream 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9:15 p.m. Eastern, and then I cut up clips of that show and I throw them out there for you on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But if you want to be part of the live show, check it out Monday, Wednesday, Fridays at 9:15 p.m. Eastern. Check it out, Zach Talks Tech on YouTube. That's ZAKTALKSTECH. Or as they call it up here in Canada, it could also be Zed. ZAKTALKSTECH. Check him out on all the socials. We'll see you there.
So anyway, it's this ongoing conversation that we've been having, because I feel like the marketing kind of gets away from us, and the conversation can kind of spiral, and we start talking about things that are sort of tangential. Oh, but this thing, and I had a Samsung once, and it was terrible. And you're like, sure, I believe it. I you're definitely true. But I don't understand this one-way direction of, I tried a cheap Android, and then I needed a phone that just works. And so I went and got an iPhone. And then they complain about things on their iPhone, and you're like, well, are you going to try a more expensive Android device? No, because iPhones just work. And you're like, that singularly seems to happen in one direction. But I feel like for Android, 2023 is going to go down as a great year for performance and battery life, and high performance at good battery life. But even then, I feel like we could be making so many more consumer-focused conversations about, like, this is the year that maybe you should have jumped on a 7 Series. You know, if your needs are a bit more minimal, you're not really trying to run your phone cameras like a mobile content creator or something like that, and you wanted, the perk that you wanted was more runtime out in the field, maybe this was the year that you should have stepped down from the high end and looked at something like a mid-ranger too. I keep having these conversations, and like, I know I get kind of quizzical looks from people when I'm super critical of both Apple and Samsung, but it's a part of the consumer education. Like last week and the week before, we were talking about folding phones. Like, it really bothers me when you look at like the advertisements for a folding phone and they still focus on, it can open. But we're not showing these devices in ways, we're not showing these devices in locations and in situations that the benefit of having the big folding tablet screen can be a benefit. I think Samsung's actually doing a pretty good job in their commercials, trying to educate sideways by just showing, I'm a busy person on the go with a Z Fold 5, so I use the outer display. And now I'm in my office desk, and I need to look at something with more scrutiny, so that's when I open the inside screen to use the bigger tablet screen. And they're not trying to say, like, hey, you're running, you're trying to catch a cab, and you're doing all this stuff, and that's the time you open the outer display for the fragile plastic to, you know, hit the pavement if you accidentally trip and drop your phone. That's the kind of stuff, like, we need to contribute a bit more to the right tool for the right job, education. But the consumers who really need to hear that stuff aren't coming to us. You know, we can say, like, oh, average consumer's this and average consumer's that. Well, the vast majority of cell phone purchasers don't watch tech videos, or at least not with any kind of regularity or with any kind of look towards being educated on the market. If anything, they're only looking at the videos that confirm what they've already purchased. So we're not instrumental in contributing to their purchasing decision. They only come to us when there's a problem and that maybe we can help them solve the problem on the back end. Sorry, I went longer on that than I thought I was going to. But it was just for me, it was an interesting kind of experience. And I know there were a bunch of people who have said, I like, who was like, was it Modern Tech Dad, Phil? I can't remember what his handle is right now. But he was like, oh, I've been using my iPhone 15 and my iPhone 15 never overheats. And like, cool. But when you've got like the BBC reporting on it, don't be that guy who's like, my phone never lag. Like, people are trying to find solutions. They have a combination of apps on their phone, services on their phone. And this is the thing, like, Apple needs to step up and support their devices. They are running into issues. Can we get better information to those consumers? Can we spread what the issues are so that people might be able to take steps to prevent those kinds of performance woes? That's where we need to do. Like, the second you see that article, if your instinct is like, but my phone never lag or overheat, then you've kind of missed the point of what we do as tech commentators and tech educators, right? You're just defending a brand. You're not contributing to a conversation. Like, if you go out there and say, like, well, I don't know what you're doing on your phone, it must be your problem that the iPhone is overheating, then, like, how is that person going to turn to techies in the future for situations that we might be able to help them with? You just lost that person who really needed to hear from you when there was a massive exploit and they need to update their phones, or when there's a recall and like they've got a faulty battery or a faulty product. Instead of like, hey, I'm using my iPhone 15 Pro a lot. These are the services that are the most used. Is it Instagram's fault? Like, if I'm not using Instagram a whole bunch and you are using Instagram a whole bunch, that might be the issue. So there you go. From Dave Burns, Modern Dad's solution for phone addiction was, it's a you problem and we shouldn't require software makers to make their software non-addictive. And then loot boxes. Way to go, Modern Dad. Yeah. Yeah, I have a hard time with anyone who's going to say, like, no, you just need personal responsibility when the entire software industry is making unregulated gambling machines. Because even Vegas regulates slot machines, right? Oh, but you don't get money. Well, then it's worse. You're putting money into these systems that are entirely random number generated and can change their algorithms on the fly to keep you as addicted as possible, because we don't even allow slot machine makers in Vegas to do that kind of BS. So I have a hard time saying, like, oh, he's got a point. It's the parents and the personal responsibility. So let's not play that game. But I want to follow this up because I was just having this whole conversation. You know, you look at the right tool for the right job. Maybe someone needs more of a mid-ranger solution. Maybe someone is the right candidate for an expensive premium phone. And we need to make clearer distinctions between the different product lines. And that is where I had a really hard time with this phone right here. This is the Xiaomi 13T Pro. This is a T-series phone. And I've never really gotten a great, clear consensus on what a T-series should represent. But the closest we all sort of generally agree upon is you start with a phone at the beginning of the year, and then halfway through the year, you're looking at probably some slightly different pricing on internal components. The market has kind of changed and adapted for different products that have shipped. And you can make a high-performance, less expensive version of the phone that you put out at the beginning of the year. So this phone is, I mean, it's a screamer. And why, as I mentioned at the top of this, I'm going to be doing a Patreon article about the new MediaTek chip that's in this phone. It's the MediaTek Dimensity 9200 Plus. And it's very reflective phone. So you can kind of see, hold on, let me get the chat. There's the chat. Now you guys can see yourself in the reflection of my phone as you are typing comments. Hooray! Some compromises over the Xiaomi 13s, different component choices, different, and then different features where a phone at the beginning of the year had 67-watt charging. This has 120-watt charging. You kind of keep moving these pieces around. But increasingly, and I said this in my video, and I kind of want to sort of, I sort of want to double down on that part of the conversation here in the podcast. Increasingly, it is getting more and more difficult to explain to a potential consumer what is different about a Xiaomi 13 versus a Xiaomi 13T. And you can say, like, well, image sensors do this, and then you've got a telephoto sensor, and then that's different, and then you've got more resolution on the ultra-wide. And I don't know how to frame that comparison in a way that people will not only understand, but care. So the reason why I'm getting a little picky on Xiaomi this year is a lot of these companies release aggressively because their sales kind of depend on the novelty of new. New phone, new phone, new phone. And I feel consumers look at the market and say, whatever phone came out most recently is probably the goodest phone. And so we've left kind of a warped perspective on what the T-series represents. You got the Xiaomi 13, that was released at the beginning of the year. Now that phone is like 6 months old. Oh, now there's the T-series. So this is the Xiaomi 13T Pro. It's the newer phone. It's probably the one that I want to look at, the one I want to shop. It's probably going to be the better phone. And it's not. Again, you're like putting all the parts and pieces together. They are they are different devices. Like they are not directly comparable when you look at a 13 Pro and a 13T Pro. And I don't know how to get that point across. I can tell you, I can break down all the differences. You got like 120-watt charging versus 60-watt charging. You've got a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 versus MediaTek Dimensity 9200 Plus. The 13 Pro has a higher resolution display, but the 13T Pro has 144 hertz. And then you've got, you know, different, one has wireless charging, the other doesn't. I mean, it's like, I can read the specs at you. I can throw specs at your face. And your face goes, blah, 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 specs. But that doesn't help inform the conversation on what it's like just to kind of like walk around and use the phone and do stuff on it. And would that matter to someone? Or does someone really care about differences in camera sensor sizes? Like, do you care about having a 1-inch type sensor or this new like Sony 707, which is a 1 over 1.28? I think it might be a cousin of the image sensor that goes into the iPhone. It's like putting all of that together, it is so difficult defining the product lines. And that's where I would really like some help from some of these manufacturers to say, like, T-Series represents this. And this is what we're trying to accomplish. And that's different than what we put out at the beginning of the year with the number phone. And I think they're afraid of more clearly defining, because I think a part of this is just new, fresh, what's novel, new videos, new conversations, new influencers talking about this stuff, new ad campaigns. And that's kind of what spurs the next little pocket of smartphone purchasing. Is people who typically buy at the end of the year are looking for that new phone at the end of the year, and then that's what they jump on. So anyway, it's kind of heady. And I don't want to single out Xiaomi as if they're unique, like they're the only ones that have this problem. Like, for example, I'm going to be putting out a video soon on this. This is the Vivo V29. And I, at the beginning of the year, put out videos on the V27. Like, if I hold this up, hold on, let me see, I don't know if I have it immediately accessible here. Yeah, this is the one. Okay. So unfortunately, I already held up one of the phones. So you know what the answer is. But if I were to, the case is like really snug on this. Nicely done, Vivo. But like, you go into an electronics store and you're like, hey, I need a good mid-ranger Vivo phone. I want something that's kind of pretty. And you hold these two up and you're like, which one would you buy? V27, V29. What are the differences? I'm like, even looking down, like they've used these larger circles for the camera modules. I don't think the camera sensors have changed dramatically. They have like, so you've got like a third circle down here. I'm pretty sure there's like a one of those, like, what do you call it? One of those monochrome sensors, and then like a little Aurolite, they call it Aurolite, just like another sort of readout sensor. That's not like a full practical camera sensor. But then there's like a little camera sensor right here, which might be kind of the same Aurolite, but then there's a different ring over here, but then the LEDs are up here. You're like, how do I make separate videos about these two products so close, months apart from each other, and detail any kind of meaningful difference to the consumer as to what these things are built to do, what they can accomplish, and how they might be different? And that's just for, like, you guys, right? You're the folks that are going to watch that video. Imagine going into like an electronics store or cell phone warehouse or some kind of like retailer and seeing these two things side by side and going, well, which one do I buy? One's older, one's newer. One has a bigger number in its name. I don't know, is the V29 two better than the V27? What is the standard of measurement? What is the metric that I'm looking at trying to accomplish this? I will point out that I do on the V27, I don't know, do I still have the weird little IR flashlight? UV flashlight. Oh, I don't know if I still have it on my desk. This is the one that has that really fancy color change back. No, I don't think I do. It's so rare that you need a UV lamp for any of your work or anything. But if you hit this with sunlight, it changes the color of the back of the phone. And it's really pretty. It's a really cool aesthetic feature. And the new one doesn't have that. So again, I'm pointing to Xiaomi because I just recently finished this 13T Pro. And it is a good phone. It's a really good phone. And in many ways, it's a great phone. But it's a great phone in a sea of competition, even from Xiaomi's own labeled brand, let alone Realme's and Poco's, and then the competition from BBK labels like Vivo and iQOO. And it's getting tricky. And I don't want to casually make an assessment on a product that leads people to say like, oh, well, yeah, it's a good phone. I should go with that one. And you're like, you really would have been better with this one, but you would have had to have watched a video from 2 months before. And the phones are coming out so rapidly, like, how do you keep up with that kind of churn? It's I'm staying up at night and I'm trying to write through scripts and I'm having to write and rewrite and rewrite to be able to correctly, in what I feel, to correctly define what I think the product can do. Oh, Aditya.
If I was forced to choose between the V27 and the V25, I'd honestly just go for a refurb iPhone 13 Pro.
Yeah, and Simon says, no, I mean, like, I'm not like singling out one manufacturer and letting go of others, but, you know, iQOO came out with the iQOO 11. They only did an 11 Pro in China, and I haven't seen any word on an 11T, but I also feel like some of the BBK brands are still facing those issues in the EU. So they might be scaling back on some of their refreshes this year because they know they're going to have difficulty selling in some markets. So what's the point of trying to push out these, like this continued churn of different devices? But I know that they were going to be doing another, what's their smaller line? Not smaller, their sort of medium line. Is it the Neo? Is the iQOO Neo? Do I have that right? So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw like a bump or some kind of refresh on that at the end of the year too. But I feel like this is such an opportunity. Like you can come out with this amazing, killer, just crushing, powerful phone. Like I've got my Vivo X90 Pro. You put this out and you make your noise with this, but then reinvest with your community throughout the year to highlight like, oh, we did this and we're doing this and we're doing that. Like TK and I were talking at this TCL event. I shot most of my little social media photos and just like my like little personal photos and stuff on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. The Xiaomi 13 Ultra launched relatively early in the year and it kind of just became my production phone of the year. I haven't seen anything like really truly unseat it. The closest would be like an Xperia 1 Mark V, my two top favorite camera and video focused phones of the year. But like, do we really need to spend all this time and effort and energy coming up with other pro devices and labeling all these other premium tier phones? This is not going to be a cheap purchase. This Xiaomi 13T Pro is still going to be an expensive phone. But it's not better than a 13 Pro. It's different than a 13 Pro. So people will look at that and say, well, it's the newer one. I don't know. Like this is a philosophical problem that I am really struggling with. And I don't want to just slam companies because I don't think that helps the conversation either. But I don't know how to stick the landing on this stuff. How do I come down to the verdict at the end of this video and then say like, yeah, if you're buying a new phone and you're buying a mid-ranger and you just saw this refresh and there's a V29, then this could be a good fit for that guy. But you could also get a refurbed phone or you could get a slightly older premium tier phone from 6 months ago. I mean, it's like, oh, okay, now I'm just repeating myself. Go Star Scream, if companies like Samsung never got into the entry or mid-range segments, they'd probably sell a lot more flagships than they currently are. They absolutely would, but they would also be selling far fewer phones. Again, with competition in the Android space, it wouldn't just be a one-to-one swap. I'm torn. Like, there are times where I feel like maybe you should get rid of the mid-ranger and use your older premium phone at a cost savings, kind of like what Apple does. You can go like two generations back from Apple on an older iPhone. But now I'm looking at some of these iPhones that are incredibly powerful devices. I feel like you do need a fuel-efficient model. Like, not everyone can drive around in sports cars. Ooh, excuse me. Got a coffee burp there on the mic. Not everyone can drive around in Corvettes. You know, sometimes you just need to have that family sedan that's good, that gets good gas mileage. And I don't mean to try and diminish that, but it still kind of holds true in smartphone land, especially on the Android side, where I want to say less than 10% are these premium tier devices offering up this, you know, screamer performance. Especially if we extrapolate out from Samsung sales, what they ship is like 9-to-1 A series to S and Z series combined. So you do need to have that kind of middle of the road. It's great for communicating. It handles this. It covers the basics. All these things that tech reviewers say people care about. And then they hold up a $1,200 Ultra. So we do kind of need that, but I don't know that it should look like this. It's like, again, I'm repeating myself again, so it's great. Oh, McCorkran, we had a couple chats about that too. Josh has a closer relationship with Asus than I did, so it was interesting getting some of the tea from him. McCorkran says, I was disappointed when there were rumors that Zenfone 10 would be the last Zenfone. I hope that doesn't end up being true. I know Asus denied it pretty aggressively, but we've seen companies do this before, like Stadia and LG. And it would kind of break my heart if that was the last Zenfone. But to the same token, I need these companies to tell people about their products and not just rely on tech reviewers to hold them up on camera and say, it's not as good as a Samsung, right? If we saw some Asus advertising, I feel they could make a really good play for a targeted niche distribution on the strengths of a small form factor phone. And to go after that market, people who are still holding on to like Galaxy S10s, right? I saw the most current Samsung device I have in my lab right now is the S10e. It was kind of a perfect daily driver phone, and it had a memory card and a headphone jack and really good cameras and a power button fingerprint sensor. It's like everything I want out of that era of smartphoning, and the Zenfone could walk into that space. I feel if a Sony could put together a meager advertising budget and work with a distribution source like B&H, because they're already selling their phones through B&H, they could put together a targeted campaign to let people know about their products. There would be some interest in search. All of our videos would get a little bit more traffic. Google would say, oh, there has been more consumer interest in this topic. Then you could promote some of that content to a broader audience, and you wouldn't keep getting stepped on by all these algorithms. But Sony doesn't want to advertise directly to consumers, and I don't get it. So if you're not going to tell customers about your products, and you're only going to send your products to tech reviewers, who the vast majority of the audiences on tech reviewers have already bought the phones that they want to use, the entertainment value of that isn't really moving new units. So I wasn't surprised to see that Asus was looking at cutting some of their phone division, but I'm not surprised. I'm just disappointed. And it's a bummer because we need more competition. But we don't acknowledge it when we have it, and consumers don't know about it because they're not turning to tech reviewers for that kind of informed commentary. Catching up with the chat, because we got some time. This is good. We have a little Q&A here. From Gabaletta. I feel like instead of a video, you could do a written piece on it. So I've been waffling back and forth. I think I might do a written review, but then a short form video just saying, can you tell which phone is a V27, a V27 Pro, and a V29? You know, I might do something like that. Do like the shell game. Like I just slide them all around on my table and then go, okay, ready, go. Which one's which? I don't know. I feel like there's just like a part of this commentary that I want to lean into, like I did with Xiaomi, because I also don't want it to just be Juan was picking on the 13T Pro. But I wanted to use that to highlight what I feel is a problem in communication and also in defining what a consumer should expect from a product. And going from the 13T Pro immediately to this V29, it is a stunningly built phone. This is like the spiritual successor to the LG Velvet in terms of aesthetics. It's gorgeous. It is a manufacturing achievement. I think Vivo has made one of the prettiest phones on the market today. But they also made this phone earlier in the year. It was called the V27. And so I still feel like there's stuff that I want to talk about here, but I think I need to save the video for, again, yet another example of this philosophy in action that I find very concerning, which is the churn rate of new phones, slapping new labels, new parts, and I feel that also probably has a detrimental effect on things like support. Because you've changed these little things from model to model to model, but that also means you're spending less and less and less on support per model because you have so many different phones to support. And I think when you can streamline some of that, you give me one series of X phones and one series of V phones. Give me a high-end series of iQOOs and a mid-ranger series of iQOOs, and then use a label for an entry-level phone to support other regions, you would significantly reduce your manufacturing costs, and you would get more mileage out of your support costs because you would have far fewer phones to support every year. So I don't get it. I'm sure they've got the numbers to suggest that this strategy is probably going to make them more money, but I feel like that's a short-term look at the market and not a good way to sustain a long-term relationship with a customer. And that, I think, is a viewpoint sorely lacking across the entire tech industry right now. Oh, go Starscream. Exactly that. I mean, I was trying to kind of get to that. The entry range is just a cluster F word. I'm trying to keep my podcast at least the semblance of PG-13. I like to be like, oh, that's poop. and getting into entry-level devices is even more of a mess. Like, how do you rate the differences between like a $150 phone and a $100 phone? And I don't spend as much time there as I should. But even just from playing with like an Infinix, and you're like, this is an astonishing amount of phone that you can get at, like, and currency conversion would be for $200. We need to extend all of these conversations out and say, like, what is it that people are really trying to do? Because I don't know that we're really building the products for what they're trying to do. Gabaletta, I agree. Samsung should honestly simplify their lineup, just have the Z, S, and A line, get rid of the rest. I understand Samsung's spread, but I wouldn't mind seeing some crossover. Like, I'd like to see the equivalent of an A series foldable. I'd like to see the equivalent of an A series with stylus support. You know, like, I don't mind a number of devices if you can clearly point to what that device should do. Like, a Note is a big niche, right? The Galaxy Note was the stylus-enabled productivity workhorse device, and especially back in the day, it was the no-compromises phone. It had all the best technology. But we also know that should not be a mainstream solution for folks out there. There are very precious few people who are going to run a Galaxy Note to get their money's worth on all of the features and all of the software and all of the hardware that's packed into that device. So when you release the Galaxy Note and it sells like 5 million units, oh, that's such disappointing sales numbers. Not really. That's kind of appropriate for what that thing is and how expensive it is. And so now that we've just squished the Note and the Galaxy Ultra into the same device, it's a Note. That's all it really is. They just got rid of the Galaxy S Ultra. Oh, wow, they're selling so many more. Yeah, but you're selling so many more to people that aren't really using that. They just wanted the bigger screen and the better battery life and the better cameras. And you could have made the S series of that phone. And I bet you the S series of that phone without the stylus would have significantly outsold the phone with the stylus. So you're kind of ratcheting your consumers there. The Note should be a niche. A stylus-enabled phone is not mainstream. We shouldn't be trying to act like, oh, that should sell 20 million units. Because there aren't 20 million people that really are going to benefit from that.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
From Michael Peppertech, I've heard that the Pixel 8a won't be getting the Tensor 3. Google looking to separate the A device from the base Pixel non-Pro model more. Also, Tensor 3 in Pixel 8 and Tensor 3 Plus for the Pro or in the Pro. Is it Tensor 3 Plus or Tensor 3 Pro in the 8 Pro? So I'll be very interested to see if there is a yield difference on Tensor 3. Because if it's the same architecture, but you've got a plus version, that means that you've got fabrication where you can divide the same chip into two qualities of performance, binning. So you look at we used to call this the silicon lottery. You can get a CPU from Intel, pop it into your motherboard, and then you can try and overclock it. And even though you can take four versions of the exact same model of CPU, and they will all have different tolerances for how well they can be overclocked. And I'll be very curious if Google is ordering enough of these chips to make that a specific distinction, that there is a version of the Tensor 3 in this phone, and there's a version of the Tensor 3 Plus in that phone. I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm just saying I'd be very curious to see if they choose to make that a distinction to customers. Whether or not that's how it really plays out in our phones, we can kind of assume, like, hey, if you've got a less expensive, like, mid-ranger phone and it also has a Tensor 2, it might not be performing to the same tier as the Tensor 2 in a more expensive phone. And that's because you can kind of classify. These chips are rated for this tier of performance. These chips, not performing as well, but they're still really good. Like, they're still going to get people through their day. But if we get to a Pixel 8a, this is going to be rough because Google does not have a mid-ranger chip. And I would prefer not to see another year of Tensor 2 in a mid-ranger. I really feel it was a bit of a mistake going Tensor 2 in the A series. Going Tensor at all in the A series. You pick up a Pixel 5a, and it is such a battery life champ. Again, it is a price to performance ratio that is fantastic. It's a very good camera. It's a snappy enough, just make it through your day. That Snapdragon 765 is a great chip, but it was a really power efficient chip. And so without doing anything fancy, that phone, I mean, for like the way that my parents, and they're tech-savvy individuals, but the way that my parents might use phones, the Pixel 5a is like a three-day phone on a single charge for them. And you can't do that with Tensor. Tensor is a much higher performance, but also much thirstier chip. So it's great. You've got an A series, you've got a mid-ranger that's more powerful. But was that what people were asking for? Someone spending $400 to $500 on a phone, did they say, you know what I really want is a higher Antutu score and not to be able to use my phone for 2 days on a charge? I wanted to sacrifice my ability to keep my phone in my purse for 3 days just so that I could, like, edit video on my phone. I don't think that's what they were asking for. I don't think someone shopping a $400 to $500 phone is thinking to themselves, you know what I need is something that can displace my laptop and is going to make my thigh hot and give me significantly less battery life. I don't see it. I don't see that being the strategy. Oh, Michael Pepperdick saying the Tensor 3 Plus would be something later for like a Tablet 2 or a Pixel Fold 2. That makes sense. Actually, that makes sense. So you would start with Tensor 3 for the products that will hopefully be announced. I mean, again, we're kind of piggybacking. I wasn't planning on talking about like Pixel rumors. Like, I do not have a Pixel 8 or 8 Pro. I'm not Scott Peachy. We know Scott, technically speaking, he probably already has a Pixel 10 and a Pixel Fold 4, right? I don't know how he does it, but he's that dude, right? But no, that would actually make a lot of sense, MPT. If we had Tensor 3, launch that with the phones, and then devices that kind of have a different expectation of use. I have a bigger screen. I'm more likely to be doing this kind of multitasking. I'm still really hoping that the rumors on like screen out, video output through the USB-C are true. I keep using this Pixel Fold and I keep thinking like it would be so cool to kind of have that dual display, larger display experience. I can prop this up like a little mini laptop, plug another display, have a big video out, and people like kind of look at me funny, but it's actually kind of cool. Right now, any phone that has video output, you don't need to have a desktop mode, but you can try this. If it has video output, plug in a monitor or a TV, and then fire up LumaFusion. And on Android, LumaFusion has a video output preview mode. So LumaFusion as an app can see that your phone is connected to another monitor, and it will send your video out to that other monitor. So you can do all of the editing from your phone screen, and then you have a larger display to look at your preview, to look at the edits that you're making. Why don't more apps do this? Think of all the games where it would be really cool. We saw this sort of dual screen usage on Asus gaming phones. You plug it in and you get your map on the phone screen, but then the gameplay video is going out to a TV. It was awesome for racing games. So many games would benefit from that. Like say you plug it in and then your phone screen turns into a controller. Like an LG. LG did that with their dual display phones. One display was playing the game, the other display was a controller, and you'd have a better, I mean, it's still a touchscreen, but you'd have better controls for controlling the game, and you'd be able to see the game on this larger TV or monitor. Like, there's so many applications where this would be a benefit, even without having a proper desktop mode, to have a computer UI. Think about photo editing. Why can't you fire up Lightroom and send your preview to a color-calibrated monitor while you make the adjustments on the phone screen? Anywhere you go, you want to, you know, you do a remote photo shoot, you could get these files in. You don't need to fire up a laptop. You could take it directly to a phone and plug it in. And you know that there are going to be some of these solutions worked on for iPhones. But again, Android had this insane lead with USB-C and USB-3, and we're going to piss it all away. So many phones have lost this capability. So I'm sorry, that was really long-winded. Michael Peppertech, I agree. I would really love to see like that refresh happen with a product, like a tablet or a foldable, where it makes sense to give that machine just a little more oomph than the phone might need. Now you've given me a distinction. I love that idea. The phone does this. It's a really high-performance phone. The foldable, we expect people are going to use it in more demanding ways. It's getting a little bit of a bump. It's getting a little bit of a nudge, just like a little 5% bump here and a boost there and a slightly better GPU. Like, that makes total sense. I would absolutely on board that kind of idea to help us line up our expectations more accurately. Let's see. I'm way behind on the chat, y'all. Yeah, Gavaletta, the difference in hardware and quality from a $100 to a $150 phone are actually substantial. It's crazy. This, and we don't keep, I don't think, those of us in my position where we're getting like really high performance stuff on the regular, I don't think we do a very good job of keeping an eye on what a $20 difference MSRP really translates to in some of those inexpensive phones. They are radically different experiences for very small differences in prices. And I think that really illustrates so many consumers across the globe. They are making their whole lives, they're living their entire digital existence through something that I would look at like a burner phone. They don't have a phone to do phone things and a tablet to do tablet things and a laptop to do laptop things. And there's the old desktop that's just kind of kicking around the home and blah, 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 blah. And like, and you need, you know, two or three devices per family member. Like, there might be a household phone and that's their computer. And they might be living their entire digital existence and multiple users on a device that I would look at like, well, this is the disposable phone that someone might use to facilitate a drug deal. They snap it in half and then they throw it in the garbage. Like, our perspective is so warped. And especially for like the next billion smartphone users. Like, there was another story. I think we talked about it a little last week. I didn't actually pull up the link. But like, there's another feature phone operating system that's gaining a whole bunch of ground in India right now. And you're like, yeah, if you can give me better messaging tools, a few basic apps and services, and the ability to do mobile payments, that's like the vast majority of smartphone use for a lot of people. And it's picking up. I mean, it's like a tiny, tiny percentage of the overall phone sold, but it's like one of the only sectors in this economy where that segment of phone, that distribution is growing. It's picking up more market share as there's kind of a constriction of the total number of devices sold. And you're like, yeah, that makes sense. Internationally, if people are struggling and they're not making enough money and like these services are hard to keep up with, are you going to look at trying to stretch yourself to another smartphone? Or could you get away for a while with like a much less expensive feature phone, but still be able to keep up with all of your digital lifestyle? So, yeah. Hassam, I need to look into this more. That is a very good question. And I had it initially on the list and I started reading through your article and realized I don't know what WTF I'm talking about. He asks, Hassam asks, any thoughts on the Humane AI pin? So there's been a lot of recent chatter about like the industry coming to talk about the dangers and the pitfalls of artificial intelligence. And that is something I'm very passionate about. We had a big debate a couple months back and people were like, oh, it's just code, Juan. How can you care about that? And you're like, I feel like we need to get ahead of a conversation where sentience might emerge in software and it's absolutely not going to happen anytime soon, but we shouldn't be surprised when it does happen. We should talk about the philosophy long before we're in danger of it coming to pass. But on top of that, just like the human impact on new technologies and AI and stuff like that. And I'm not qualified yet to share much of an opinion on some of these early conversations in this space. So I'd really like to maybe revisit that for maybe even a future video topic. And maybe I need to shift into some more of those like video commentaries on some of these industry plans. I don't think we keep enough scrutiny on what happens with these companies, and we should try to follow up more frequently. Yeah, Baseball Super, going back to Tensor 2 for mid-rangers, Baseball Super says, if Tensor 2 was good, they might have made a mid-range chip. I understand the strategy, because what they're doing is they're looking at Apple. Apple doesn't make a dedicated mid-ranger chip. So they're making Tensor, and then they're using older Tensor for less expensive devices. But unfortunately, I wish it were as simple as, like, you could take Tensor and then maybe unplug a Samsung radio and plug in a MediaTek radio. But unfortunately, that's not the way it works. And so you're sort of stuck with the design of Tensor 2. And so let's say a Pixel 8a comes out and it has Tensor 2, or maybe a refined Tensor 2 Plus, right? Maybe they even tweak the manufacturing a little bit. It's not going to be a fundamentally different chip than Tensor 2. So what you end up with is someone who has a very high performance chip in a mid-ranger phone, but that's going to come at the expense of some battery life and thermal performance, and I don't think the modem or the radio is going to be as good as a Qualcomm, so some signal issues depending on where you live. And I don't know that that's the experience that consumers are signing up for when they say, I want the middle Pixel, or I want the less expensive Pixel. Oh, McCorkran. My dad is still on a Pixel 4a. And McCorkran says, I still use my Pixel 4a almost every day. My dad doesn't want to give it up. Tiny, small form factor, Android phone, sleek, good camera. He's set. He actually doesn't want to go to a Pixel 5a just because it's bigger. I mean, like, we might lose my dad as an Android user just because he'll be able to get a smaller iPhone. Right? Like, that's it. My uncle, Galaxy S9, he does not want a super huge phone. But all of the compromises that you've got to make, like, he cannot match a phone to his Galaxy S9. And I'm heartbroken because we're not getting the Xperia 5 Mark V here in the United States. That was his holdout. He was waiting to see news on the Xperia 5 Mark V. I'm going to text him this afternoon just because, like, I don't know what to tell him. Like, I think the next closest thing, he's just going to have to stick with Samsung for the smaller form factor of the S23. But at this point, he might as well just wait and see what they do with an S24. Breaks my heart. Breaks my heart. We were looking up maybe going Asus, but I think he also got a little gun-shy on all the announcements that they were cutting parts of their mobile division. And he doesn't want to go into this like, well, it'll be a good phone for a year or two. He still has a Galaxy S9. He wants a phone that will maybe match the longevity what he just did with his Galaxy S9. But unfortunately, like, the phone he wants doesn't exist. Because he'd still like to have a memory card. I think he could probably give up his headphone jack. That one might not be a deal breaker for him. But that's the opposite of the Zen phone. He'd keep the headphone jack, but he wouldn't be able to keep a memory card slot. And so then he started looking at pricing. He's like, it's silly. Why would I spend that much for 512 gig of storage when I already have a 512 gig memory card? And you're like, yeah, but unfortunately, they don't exist anymore. So it's tough. There more and more people, especially like from nerds like me, you know, like the LG brethren. Where do I go after my V60? I got another email from someone, and like I had to say, there isn't a place to go. If you really liked the things that were fun features on your LG V60, you're done. There is no device that you can really replicate all of the same kinds of use. Yeah, a cup of cash, absolutely. So I hope everyone here, we need to see, will Google credit Michael Peppertech? Chip strategy. Kappa Cash says, yeah, I like the idea. Put the more demanding chip for the more demanding device. And yes, yeah, I really hope that comes to pass, MPT. This is another really curious place right now. MPT says, I would be curious to know if Google will put a Tensor chip into a Chromebook eventually. Would be awesome to see some chip-to-chip advantages between Pixel and Chromebooks via both using the same chip. I just got an announcement. Who was it from? Acer. So Acer was really aggressive. They just came out with like a new classification for like Chromebook Plus or something like that. And we're looking at Intel 12th gen and 13th gen CPUs going into Chromebooks and convertibles and stuff like that. So I haven't heard as much noise. And someone please correct me if I'm just missing something. I haven't seen as much noise on ARM-powered Chromebooks. MediaTek last year made some noise about Companio, but I personally saw more and held more devices with Companio chips in tablets. And I think we saw some Companio in Lenovo. Lenovo put out one of their tabs had a Companio in it. But I haven't seen as many Chromebooks. So I think Chromebooks are still sliding a little bit more x86. So I'd be very curious to see. I feel like the compute power that we could get in like a Snapdragon 7 Gen 2 is significant overkill for what someone would want to use a Chromebook for. We still have the Pixelbook Go, and I'm really excited because like we're going to get extended support. Google opened up. You're now going to get like up to 10 years of software support from the launch of the Chromebook. So I'm happy. That poor Pixelbook has just been put through the ringer. It's been my wife's sort of carry around the house computer. It's been my sort of internet portal before I started using more like Windows on ARM. My daughter is using it for school, and she put some hard miles on that Pixelbook. But yeah, it seems to me that right now Intel is currying more favor with Pixelbooks. And I think Acer might be looking at doing an AMD AMD Chromebook, not Pixelbook. They might be doing an AMD Chromebook this year. And I don't know, I've seen many AMD powered Chromebooks. So again, to Michael Peppertech's point, like, we have all of these different ways of generating computing performance, and they're all kind of stepping on each other. And it's tough to point someone to say, like, hey, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? This is a little bit better at this, and that's going to be a little bit better at that, and then you can do that, or you could just buy a MacBook. Because a MacBook just Macs. McCorkran, yeah. I also noticed that tech reviewers like to pretend that people can't buy old phones. Like, they act like you have to choose between phones released in the last 6 months or you go to prison. All right, let's see. Oh, Simon says Hypno. My dad was the same about phone size till he realized that he didn't have to hold the phone 3 feet away and squint to read it. I don't know. I don't know what my dad will do, because I think he genuinely still likes I put the phone in a shirt pocket or in a jacket pocket. Like, I think that's part of the metric. Like, to him, it's not about performance, and he can blow up the screen size. Like, I think the font size is set to large on his phone. Like, he's still doing fine there. I think it's literally just, do I have a phone that is responsive enough for me to do what I want on it? His gaming level tops out at Spider. He loves, like, solitaire card games on his phone, so you don't need a ton of performance there. It lasts him well over a day on a charge on his use. He can look up restaurant reviews when he wants to like travel or go out to eat. Like, it's perfect. And then when he's like done using it for that brief interaction, he puts it back in a shirt pocket and it stays put. It's like the perfect size for that. And I don't think anything like that exists now. Anything that he would move to, he would have to put the phone in a different pocket. I think that might be a deal breaker. So, McCorkran, I'm a little worried about the future of ARM-based Chromebooks, too. I'm hoping to see a little bit more noise on that front, just because Chromebooks took such a hit at the end of the pandemic, but it's also like this huge installed user base. So now that you've got all these people and all these students on Chromebooks, we need to start rebuilding the not just the manufacturing, but also the marketing and the conversation and the relationship with all of those consumers, so they stay with Chromebooks if that's what they want to use. But I need to end this because my voice is killing me right now, and I realize I've kind of out-talked. We went a little long, and I wanted to, and I really appreciated this Q&A and stuff. But yes, stay on the lookout, Patreon. I'm going to be writing up the performance charts. Someone hit me up offline if you have a suggestion for better graph software, so that we can make some better looking representations of these performance charts. And if you want to catch some of those, it's going to be on the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. I do a sort of a yearly block. So every time we get new devices for the year. And this is also going to be a little interesting because one of the tests I run is batch photo compression. Batch photo processing. And the app I use, Photomate R3, just recently had an update that was very surprising. So unfortunately, my older charts don't directly compare. It was something like almost a 15% performance improvement on batch processing raw files. So now I go back and like, if you compare my older scores against my newer scores, they're not fair. And I reran the Xiaomi 13 Ultra while I was reviewing the 13T Pro just to see like what's changed. And both Dimensity and Qualcomm SoCs saw about a 10 to 15% performance improvement chewing through raw photos. I love this photo editor because it's like Lightroom if you never want to pay a subscription, but it's also like really messy looking software. Like you can tell this is a tiny little developer, maybe one guy in his basement. I don't know how many people really work on this app, but when I chew up raw files or when I try and do like stacks, you know, like say you want to take a stack of raw images and smush them all together, it's pretty good. I like it a lot. So I like to use it in my tests and show it off. But that's going to be going to the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. I'm going to have a video out hopefully soon talking about Vivo. I'm going to have a video out hopefully soon talking about TCL Nextwear S, because we might be seeing some refreshed TCL glasses on the horizon very, very soon. I've been very excited playing with Rokid and Xreal, and TCL was the company that got me started on this product segment, so we're going to be talking about that too. So, some really fun tech gadgety stuff coming up. I really appreciate folks dropping by. This was a great chat. I really needed this chat just to kind of hang out and talk about some of this stuff. So be on the lookout. Techtober is gearing up full swing. We've got a bunch of phones. I still need to talk about some fitness trackers and some bands and some stuff here on my desk that I can't hold up or I'll get savaged for agreeing to embargoes. But let me just tell you, we're going to be having some fun. This is going to be a fun fun month to get through. It's a lot of work. And please pardon if my videos start getting real simple. Here are my hands holding this gadget. It is good. Okay, bye. Love you. So thank you, everybody, for dropping by. Again, huge thank you to Muppinish and Jman150. They're fanfare, no soundboard fanfare of glory for your support and your contributions and all the tier one subs that you gifted. I really do appreciate it. And we're going to be back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show. Also be on the lookout. TK and I are going to have a podcast coming up this week. There's some really great folks that are doing live streams like Gadget Goddess and Easy Computer Solutions. You'll see cats like Barry Johnson and LaShawn and all those folks sort of populating those streams. Really, really great tech commentary. Almost every day of the week, you can find some great streamers having really engaging conversations. Not just, well, this is the best and that's the one you should buy. But the debate and the conversation and the education on this stuff is really fun too. So everybody, I want you to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And also, I want you to continue taking care of yourself so you can be that resource and help take care of others. Be that good tech neighbor that I know you don't get enough credit for being in your circle of family and friends. Catch you back here next week. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.